If we have an across-the-board income tax of, say, 20%, that would mean that the guy who makes $50,000 a year would pay $10,000. The guy who makes $500,000 a year would pay $100,000, and the guy who makes $5 million a year would pay $1 million. So people are paying different amounts, but they are paying at the same rate. That's fair. And I think that's fairness as most people understand the term. But to the anti-colonial mindset, none of this is even relevant. The anti-colonialist believes that the rich have become rich at the expense of the poor. The wealth of the rich doesn't really belong to them, therefore whatever can be extracted from them is automatically just. If you could take everything they have, that would mean they were paying their fair share, because their fair share is actually 100%. Recall what Obama's father said in his 1965 paper, "There is no tax rate that is too high, and even a 100% tax rate can be justified under certain circumstances." Now, certainly President Obama can't say any of this. But if he believes it, that would explain why he seems indifferent to the magnitude of bills that he is racking up on behalf of the taxpayer. Obama's intention is to extract all that money from the overclass, and this, to him, is the hidden benefit of all this stimulus. It's not simply where the money goes, it's also a matter of making the fat cats pay. How delicious it must be for President Obama to run a $1 trillion tab and hand it over to the overclass. How much he must wish he could tell his father about it, so that they could both laugh their heads off at how the tables have been turned. Yes, Dad sure would be proud if he could see him now. Obama's most significant economic achievement to date is not financial regulation, but healthcare reform. While the financial regulations were a response to an acknowledged crisis, the healthcare reform was not. Admittedly, Obama acted as though this was all part of some grand economic strategy to put the country back on track. But if anything, the high cost of Obama's healthcare program will further burden the economy and stall future growth. We have to admire Obama's persistence here. The Clintons tried with healthcare and failed. Obama suffered some stinging setbacks, especially with Scott Brown's election in Massachusetts. Even so, Obama got the job done and signed America's biggest new federal program since the Great Society in the 1960s. Now, Obama was certainly right that healthcare in America is expensive and costs in recent years have soared. He also identified some other problems with the system, such as the fact that people who went from one company to another couldn't take their health insurance with them. Obama neglected to point out that the government was largely responsible for health insurance not being portable. That's because during the federal government-imposed wage and price controls of World War II, companies found that providing health insurance was a way to give employees compensation that went beyond the limits imposed by the law. That's how we got employer-provided rather than individual-purchased health insurance. But the biggest problem with America's healthcare system was, of course, cost. Obama made it sound as though high costs were preventing millions of Americans from getting health care. This was totally bogus. Even Americans who didn't have health insurance, either because they couldn't afford it or because they chose not to buy it, could still get treatment. No one, for instance, with a serious condition gets turned away from a hospital emergency room. Hospitals are absorbing those costs and, of course, passing them on to paying customers. So, granted, this is one factor driving up insurance premiums. But the most important reason America's healthcare system is so costly is that it's the best healthcare system in the world. America leads the world in new drug development, and Americans have higher survival rates for most major illnesses from cancer to heart disease. Better quality costs more. Also, people are living longer these days, and when we get older, our health needs and the cost of meeting those needs rise. Technology now makes it possible to treat more illnesses and to prolong longevity, and all of this is very expensive. Now, of course, we want to keep that quality while reducing costs. Is there a way to do that? Yes. Perhaps the biggest single factor driving up costs is that the healthcare customer is not the one who is typically paying. If I go to my doctor and say my head hurts, the doctor is going to want to run a bunch of tests. He's probably going to do every possible test because he doesn't want to leave even the slightest chance that he'll miss something and get sued. Now, the reasonable question for me to ask is, what tests do you think are the most effective? And how much is each one going to cost? But in fact, I never ask that question because I'm not the one who is paying for the tests. My insurance company is paying. I'm only going to fork over the $20 copayment. So my attitude is, test away. Clearly, the best way to reduce healthcare costs and reduce health insurance premiums is to restore customer control to the process. Why not leave America's healthcare system in place but alter the incentives that people face? If there was a way to put the money in the customer's pocket, then the customer would make sure that the money, his money, was wisely spent. This was not Obama's approach. In fact, it did not receive serious consideration. When Republicans proposed market-based approaches that empowered consumers, Obama was respectful but uninterested. Consequently, not a single Republican voted for Obama's health bill. Obama could have modified his plan by incorporating some Republican suggestions. This would not only have brought some GOP moderates to his side, it would also have increased public support for his program. Obama made no such effort. He completely ignored the Republicans. Politically, Obama's conduct is strange. Every great society program enjoyed substantial bipartisan support. Even the controversial Bush tax cuts, enacted shortly after George W. Bush was elected, were supported by 28 Democrats in the House and 12 Democrats in the Senate. Obama could have won at least modest Republican support if he really wanted to. So why didn't he want to? The reason, I suspect, is that for Obama, the Republicans are the neo-colonial party. They are not just wrong, they are evil. Consequently, Obama will play nice, but only for show. In reality, he has no desire to work with the enemy. But what about the health insurance companies? Aren't they Obama's real enemy? Yes and no. Obama has mercilessly lashed out at the insurance companies. The Washington Post reports that in a single speech, he castigated insurance companies 22 times. Among his comments, "We allow the insurance industry to run wild in this country." For him, the insurance companies are part of the neo-colonial problem. But here is the key point. They are only part of the problem as long as they are operating freely, raising prices and exploiting the customer. But if the insurance companies can be brought under government supervision and government mandate, then they have been decolonized and become part of the solution. The ingenuity of Obama is to devise a comprehensive health care plan that the insurance industry would support. And indeed, they did support it. They even agreed to spend $150 million in ads to promote it to the public. Why would insurance companies do this? Is this a case of Lenin's prediction that the capitalists would sell the rope which would then be used to hang them? Let's return to what genuine healthcare reform would look like. Such reform would be limited to providing catastrophic health insurance to Americans who could not afford it. Think about it. If I drop a lamp in my study and it breaks, I don't need insurance to replace it. Why not? Because I can afford to buy a new lamp. But if my house floods or burns to the ground, I need insurance. Why? Because that's a catastrophic loss that I cannot afford. Similarly with healthcare, if I have a cold, I and most Americans can afford $100 to go to the doctor, or even realize that a cold will go away on its own and I don't need to see a doctor at all. But if I need open-heart surgery, then I need insurance. Now, catastrophic health insurance is much cheaper than full coverage insurance because catastrophic events are rare. Consequently, Obama could have mandated catastrophic coverage for all Americans, with the government subsidizing the cost for low-income Americans. This, arguably, would have been reasonable and affordable health care reform that could have won bipartisan support. Instead, Obama opted to force every American to buy comprehensive health insurance and to force companies to provide insurance to people with pre-existing conditions. Predictably, the health insurance companies didn't like the latter provision. In fact, from an insurance point of view, it made no sense to insure people who were already sick. The whole point of insurance is for healthy people to put money into a pot so that if someone gets sick in the future, there's a pool of money to pay for treatment. But Obama brought the insurance companies around by showing them that his overall scheme actually meant much more business for them. If all Americans are compelled by law to buy comprehensive health insurance, where are they going to buy it from, except from the insurance companies? So rally round the president, boys, because there is money to be made. You see here why the charge that Obama is a socialist is once again off the mark. Obama is quite happy to rally the corporate capitalists to his side with the promise of big bucks, as long as the corporate capitalists are willing to succumb to a government leash and to being told what to do by Big Daddy Obama. The president is eager to create an alliance between the government and big corporations when it serves the anti-colonial agenda. The cost, of course, is borne by the American taxpayer. In the case of health insurance, the tab is estimated to be in the range of $1.6 trillion over the next decade. I'm not a math major, but even I can add up the numbers. The bank bailout, $700 billion this year. Stimulus, between $800 billion and $1 trillion this year. Proposed environmental and energy regulations, approximately $1 trillion over the next several years. Healthcare, $1.6 trillion over the next decade. What is Obama doing to America? The U.S. government is now $8 trillion in debt, and the Congressional Budget Office projects that another $12 trillion will be added over the next decade. Obama didn't create these huge numbers, but he has been adding to them faster than any previous president. This fiscal year alone, the Obama deficit is $1.4 trillion. These debts are liabilities owed by the American taxpayer, and they have to be paid now or in the future. About 45% of our public debt is held by individuals and governments of foreign countries, especially China and the oil-rich Muslim countries. China alone is sitting on reserves in excess of $2 trillion. If the Chinese demanded their money right now, it's hard to see how America could afford to pay. Debts, like ideas, have consequences. In their book, The End of Influence, economists Stephen Cohen and Bradford Long argue that as a consequence of American indebtedness to the rest of the world, American influence is likely to decline. The United States will continue to be a world leader, but it will no longer be the boss. A similar point is made by Fareed Zakaria in The Post-American World. America's economic position does not, despite the opinions of some pundits, signal the end of capitalism. But it might well mean the end of a certain kind of global dominance for the United States. The crisis has had the effect of delegitimizing America's economic power. The current economic upheaval will only hasten the move to a post-American world. While most Americans are likely to view this change with foreboding, I see a lone man in the Oval Office watching these trends that he has helped to exacerbate, cheering them on, and grinning in triumph.